Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 43. All right, so here's a quick little backstory on this episode that you probably don't need to know. This episode is Chris Anderson, the editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine. He's a terrific guy, and I've been pals with him for a couple years. And this episode was recorded months ago. It was actually the first episode that I recorded with the new Zoom H4n recorder. And what I didn't know is that there's a certain setting that will kick your files into other folders on the little flash drive. So I recorded this, went home, and thought I lost it. I thought I hadn't recorded anything. And it wasn't until a couple days ago that I was sifting through the H4n, and I went, oh, what do these other folders contain? Lo and behold, the Chris Anderson podcast. So this is a public apology to Chris. This was literally recorded like 5 months ago. So I found it, and I'm putting it up as quickly as I possibly could. So here it is, the Nerdist Podcast number 43 with Chris Anderson. Also, if you're going to be in Austin, Texas, I will be performing at Fun Fest on November 4th. Then November 11th through the 14th, I'll be at Laughing Skull in Atlanta. And then the 18th through the 21st, I'll be at the Addison Improv in Addison, Texas. All right, that's enough talking. Poor Chris Anderson has been put off long enough. Here you go. Love you, Chris Anderson.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's just sort of a loose chat, really. It's, you know, we'll probably cover... Well, I'll just... I made a list of jumping off points, but it really... My podcast is very, very loose and conversational.
And it's weekly?
It's weekly, yeah. Although sometimes I'll put up a bonus episode because a lot of times with guests that I get, I record when they can record. So, like, if John Hamm can do one day, it's not like I can go, well, in a month I'll get you. Yeah. So I've stockpiled quite a few.
All right. And what's it called?
It's called The Nerdist.
The Nerdist, good.
The Nerdist Podcast.
I have a nerdier podcast than you.
Is there a DIY Drones podcast?
There is.
Well, that is. Well, I was going to ask when, and I apologize for asking this question because I'm sure it's irritating if you are in the UAV biz. When did UAVs shift from just being remote control planes? Is that more of like a Radio Shack toy?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, in World War II, we had UAVs that were target planes, mm-hmm. and those were all radio controlled. The notion of autonomy kicked in, I think, you know, in the late 1980s. So the first autonomous UAVs were cruise missiles.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 1980s, the first experimental autonomous UAVs that had reconnaissance missions were developed, and then it kind of the 1990s were the beginnings of the big scale military applications, sort of the World War I aviation period of UAVs. But for the hobbyist community, the amateurs, the first you know, the first broadly available autonomous vehicles, fully autonomous, you know, with navigation, et cetera, probably kicked in around 10 years ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. Maybe, early 2000s.
Now, I don't know if, were you at Maker Faire this year?
I was.
You were probably the only magazine editor who was also at Maker Faire this year, displaying stuff, like not just there as a...
I was on my knees trying to inflate a robotic blimp. And, I was sitting there, and it was like they opened at 10, and the freaking thing, the helium got, you know, the nozzle got blocked, and I had somebody holding it so it wouldn't fly away while I was trying to put stickers on it, and I'm surrounded by, my tank fell over. And Dale Doherty, who runs Maker Faire, you know, comes by as I'm there, and he's like, the grim realities of running a small business. And I realized that this was true, that in a sense, everybody at Maker Faire is running a small business. Mm-hmm. And running a small business is about being on your knees, you know, trying to get the helium to go into the blimp so you can put up your display. You do everything. You're the janitor, right? And in my day job, of course, we're a more mature industry, and I'm not the janitor. But in the new industrial revolution, you know, everybody sweeps the floor.
I love Maker Faire, although I can never figure out like what the it's like Burning Man to Nerdcraft ratio is. Just like there's that sort of
is moving. It moves around a bit. I would say that the Burning Man crowd was in evidence this year because the Burning Man crowd brings theatrics.
Right.
You know, fire belching and, you know, moving stuff and steampunk opera and all this kind of stuff. And so the kids were kind of one of the themes this year. And so entertainment was required. They had the Diet Coke Mentos guys, although they're not the Coke Zero Mentos guys, which is annoying.
That is weird.
Yeah. I mean, they're lovely guys. And they came by and they signed a little nozzle for me, which I brought home. Anyway, the Coke Mentos guys were there and OK Go was there. But it did mean that a lot of the kind of charismatic, theatrical, sculpturesque stuff that the Burning Man is known for was on display. And as a result, and because it's so much bigger and now professional, that a lot of the little guys got kind of crowded out.
Oh, that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah. This was ever thus, right? I mean, you know, the Homebrew Computing Club, you know, turned into Circuit City and, you know, then the hackers had to go somewhere else.
That's true.
I think this is kind of one of the costs of success is that, you know, as you mainstream the fringe goes elsewhere, the hacker spaces, the dojos.
There's gonna be a slam dance Maker Faire at some point. Some sort of rebellious.
You know, but it's not gonna be Maker Faire. I mean, it's gonna be it's the long tail of everything. You know that you're inevitably there's a place for the super focused, super geeky, fringy subcultures, and I think this has got to be this is one of those cycles of culture.
Yeah.
That when subcultures become cultures, they need to create their own. They need to create a new generation of subcultures that reject, you know, that go elsewhere. They're not just forced out.
Seriously, like how long were we using the term alternative music? And it's like this music is not alternative anymore. Like it's not. It's technically that's the label that stuck because we don't know what else to call it. But it is not alternative to pop anymore.
There was I remember as an anecdote. It's a few years old now that there was an 8-bit. You know, chiptune community.
Mm-hmm.
Making sort of, you know, using Nintendo's.
We have one. My theme song to the podcast is by a chip rock band called Onomatoguchi. Yes, I'm familiar.
So, in their quest for authenticity and sort of true street cred, they not only declined to release a CD and declined, but they also declined to release MP3s or to stream. And the only way you could get the music was via a 7-inch flexi disc.
Uh-huh.
And it turned out, it turned out there was only one factory in the world that makes 7-inch. Remember flexi discs, the ones that were in magazines?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Any on them?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I had one at the Bloom, when the Bloom County book came out, they published a song that Bill the Cat supposedly sang. And so I had that. It sounded horrible.
It sounded horrible, and they were always bent, and you really did need to put a succession of coins on top of them to keep the needle from bouncing off them. But so this band, you know, only these bands, I think, only released in 7-inch flexi disc because, you know, if you had heard the song, you were one of those chosen 300
mm-hmm.
who had actually gotten their hands on the physical on the physical product. And so this sort of, you know, enforced, you know, obscurity through distribution barriers to entry is the requirement of cool in an age when everybody can get everything.
Yeah, and it's funny because in a way it's sort of like, oh, we're being rebellious. And it's like, well, what you're really... You're conforming to nonconformism in a sense. You know what I mean? Like the velvet roping of it all, that's a tactic. You know, it's that feels like sort of a popularity tactic.
It is. I mean, this is the when I was a kid, you wanted to wear the cool T-shirt. Now, you know, the T-shirt that like everybody else wore. Now you want to wear a T-shirt that nobody else understands. If you can understand my T-shirt, I failed.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like naming a thing. Like if you can name something, you understand it. Like, oh, I know what that shirt is referencing. Like, ah,
it's
crap. It's all over.
My 7-year-old, told me in I believe September of last year that Lady Gaga was over.
Whoa!
And I'm not actually sure she knew who Lady Gaga was, but someone had mentioned Lady Gaga, and she knew that the instinctive, when you hear something new, you must immediately say that it's over.
Right.
That's what 7-year-olds know.
There's no present. There's only a past and a future.
Like, exactly.
There's no...
Precisely. It's like there's got to be a Heisenberg uncertainty principle. If you can observe it, it's over.
The minute you measure Lady Gaga, you have destroyed the experiment of Lady Gaga.
Schrodinger's pop star has died.
Schrodinger's Gaga. We put Lady Gaga in a box. She's either dead or she's either hot or she's not.
She's obscure or she's dead.
Yeah, she's obscure. She's dead.
So have we started?
Yeah. We've started a while ago. I'm pretty sure we're still recording. Yeah. This is a new recording device that I'm using, and I actually really like it a lot. It sounds pretty good. I technically have been working for you for the last couple of years after we did the Wired Science TV show, and then I started contributing to the magazine, which has been super, super fun.
The brown nose portion of the show?
This is the brown nose portion of the show. If you could just spread those cheeks a little farther, I'll really get in there. But honestly, the thing that was funny to me is that we did this TV show, and you famously do not own a television set.
That's actually a lie.
Oh, it is? Okay.
I famously say I don't own
a television set. Okay, all right.
The truth is that it's hard to even define what a television set is anymore.
Yeah.
We own screens.
You have screens that have data on them.
We have screens that have pictures on them, and those pictures, those moving pictures, you know, sometimes include television programming. They're not live, you know, but they're all that come by the internet or DVDs or things like that. But I think it's getting increasingly hard to say that you don't watch television. It's hard to say you don't own a television set anymore.
It really is, and I'm trying to figure out. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm starting to already show signs of old personism. But when people say, you know, like with Google TV or that may be coming out and, you know, like, oh, you know, we're going to integrate the television and the web experience. And I always feel like I don't want those two things integrated because I like the way I consume television in a different way that I consume my web experience. And I don't, I mean, you know, you've been able to, you know, use your television as, you know, you can hook your computer up to your television and you can, and I don't like that experience. Like, I like them separate. Like that? Am I crazy, or do you think?
No, I don't know whether you're crazy because I think that probably is where I draw the line. You know, we have so basically, you know, we have screens around the house, and the screens are connected to Xboxes by and large. And those Xboxes do things, and sometimes those things are games, and sometimes those things are playing DVDs, and sometimes those things are time shifted video content kind of. Was streamed over various ways, and sometimes they're Netflix streaming movies, and I some of those things originated in broadcast television. Some of them never did. Some of them originated on the internet. Some of them originated as films. You know, I don't. These semantic distinctions are the horseless carriage era, where we have this language from the last generation. I haven't come up with a language from the next generation. You know, my kids basically sort of say, well, there's like, you know, there's basically, moving pictures that I control, moving pictures that I don't control.
Right.
You know, the first category is games, and the second category is produced content of various sorts.
And in the old days, web pages were just text.
They would say, I mean, they're addicted to screens. That's what they say. We're addicted to screens. And they'll pretty much gravitate to any screen anywhere, and they'll do what they can. And if they can push at it and make stuff happen, they'll totally do that. If they can't push at it and it's just going, then they're okay with that. By and large, this you know, I think in the same way that's impossible to wall out pop culture, you know, today, it's kind of around us. I think it's probably impossible to not watch television.
Yeah.
You know, you thought you were visiting Failblog, but in the end, it turned out you were watching television.
Right. There's a lot of Failblog on television right now. But I'm trying to figure out if they recently did a study, and they according to the study, they feel that college kids today are less empathetic than the previous generation. And do you think there's some, you know, because people are so, you know, we're so interactive with our devices and so just kind of in our own little worlds that we're not as empathetic as a culture anymore, like the next generation of people?
You know, I'm really loath to, have a strong opinion about this, or more to the point, subscribe to the, you know, to the notion that, you know, that technology has undermined our humanity. I think what happens is, first of all, generational differences, or, you know, the kids these days, you know,
right.
Rock and roll did the same thing, I'm sure. Generational differences are much more profound than technological differences. Nick Carr has a new book out called The Shallows, which I'm generally resistant to the notion that the internet makes you stupid. But I'm willing to accept the notion that the internet makes you think different. And Nick Carr's book, which I was originally disinclined to agree with, I actually found quite compelling. And what he argues in the book is that the web in particular, and let's not call the web the end state of the digital era, but the web is the current state of the digital era. The web has developed, its personality. And its personality is the sort of the, basically 16 tabs, 30-second session time, sort of thing. There's definitely a multitasking sort of, ADD component to it. It's just the it's by virtue of infinite access to an ultimate, to an unlimited amount of content and distractions, it ends up to be atomized and relatively non-immersive. What he argues is that's training us to focus on the superficial.
Mm-hmm.
It is the plasticity of our brain. And you can measure this actually. The web is changing our brains, and it is evolving our connections, our synapses, and neurons to focus on shiny. The momentary distractions, in a sense. There does seem to be some neuroscience that says that we are becoming more ADD as a result. Now, whether that leads to less empathetic, I'm not sure. I would say the web has made me more empathetic because the consequences of my bad actions are now incredibly evident to me.
Right.
I mean, when I look, as I kind of, have more and more of a public persona, and, just before we started, I was checking my Twitter feed to see whether I was being mocked for saying something for saying something wrong. And I'm now in the old days I could behave badly and then sort of, walk off, feeling smug, without really thinking about the consequences.
Yeah.
Now the consequences of bad behavior are right in my face.
That's funny, because whenever I'm watching Mad Men, I just like, well, of course he could screw whoever he wants. Like there's no one, there's no cameras, there's no information network. Like there's no anything.
Gawker's not going to out him.
Yeah, exactly. No one's going to find out anything in this world unless you tell them, because that was their information channel.
The upside of no privacy is that the incentive to lead a blameless life has never been greater.
or at least just be more careful about guarding the
whatever
you're trying
to protect.
Long ago.
No, I'm going to go with the lead a blameless life.
I'm so glad, by the way, that you admit to still kind of. I've been online since, the early days of chat rooms. I mean, I had, like one of those original AOL accounts, and, I remember even back then kind of going on to be like, oh, are people watching what I'm doing on television? This is like 1994.
Mm.
And being burned by it because, it's easy. Like you can see 10 positive things and one negative thing, and you'll be like, negative thing.
I know.
It's
the ratio even as low as that? I mean, I would say it's like, all day long I'll have like hundreds of positive, productive encounters, And, you know, when I go home at night, the one I'm stewing about is that jerk. You know, that jerk who didn't like my iPad.
who probably just dismiss. You know, I get frustrated with the kind of dismissive nature where, you know, like, even I did a bonus podcast for WWDC that was an addition to the regular weekly podcast, because I know that not everyone's an Apple fan. Right. And so some guy wrote something like, oh, you know, now you're just going to suck Steve Jobs' dick in your podcast. And like, and it was so dismissive. Just like, you don't have to listen to it, guy. You know, like, come
know,
on.
I mean, come on, we're grown-ups. How yeah, do you think we're still falling for this? I mean, it's, you know, this is why we get married. So that someone saner than us can tell us to get to just don't be silly and ignore those jerks.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, this, you know, you know, really, I mean, I can tell you that, you know, the guys who said, you know, who say, you know, I do something and then someone will just say, like, you know, that sucks.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, but, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, I turn into this 12-year-old.
Are you a Bill Hicks fan at all?
I mean, I'm not a Knot fan. I'm not sure.
Bill Hicks was this kind of revolutionary voice in comedy. Like, he died a long time. He died really young of cancer. He's probably been dead for 12 or 14 years. But anyway, when there was this comedy boom in the 80s and the early 90s and everyone was doing jokes about, you know, ladies going to the bathroom in groups, Bill Hicks was out touring America and basically just saying, like, you know, he was doing the kind of stuff that today would still be considered edgy. America's fat, America's stupid, but not just, you know, like, yeah. He actually had jokes. But it's online, but he famously became unhinged specifically because some woman just said something like, you suck. Yeah. And just the idiotic, you know, because there was no regard whatsoever, it's so dismissive, he unloads on her, like, drops the C-bomb like 15 times and just like, get her the fuck out of here, and screaming, and yeah, it's just amazing.
You know, there's something, we should think about this, because, you know, why is it? I mean, we are mature, evolved, developed people. But why is it that something, you know, a schoolyard taunt, you know, like that gets us in the way that a kind of a logical deconstruction of our hard work wouldn't? And I think it's that this the intrinsic unfairness of the kind of ad hominem attack. It brings out this I'm being bullied,
right,
you know, sense, and I just want to punch someone in the nose.
You know, I think part of it is I think it just hits one of those ancient brain structures, and it wires right around your higher brain functions, and you sort of feel like, I think it's just about like a tribe acceptance thing, and you're sort of like, but wait, I'm working so hard, you know, like this is the perfect.
What have you done?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, sucks in what way? Tell me more.
Yeah, come on, seriously. You know, my friend Mike made this Photoshop picture that got passed around a lot, but it was basically from a fart contest, which was, you know, put your favorite movie in a different time period. So he took this painting of the Ascension of Christ and put in the Ghostbusters behind him trapping Christ in the proton beams.
Nice.
And he called it Ghostbusters 0 BC. And all those people were like, technically that would have been 33 BC. And it drove him crazy, because you realize the internet, the web, is effectively, you know, if you imagine you have an adopted kid and his adopted mother, and the kid says, I love you, mom, the web is the guy that leans in and goes, it's not really your mom, you know. You're like, why do you have to do that?
This is what we created, the world's greatest platform for pedants.
It really is. But I also wonder if, and this is sort of branching off the free idea from the book that you wrote, Free.
I take it all back.
You take it all back. It's all gone now. Are we now a culture of spoiled babies? Like, because when people react that way so dismissively to free content,
I know. Especially to free content.
Are we spoiled because now people are like, oh, well, that's dumb. Really? Because you didn't pay anything for it. And, you know, is attention the new currency? Because they feel like they're paying for it with their time?
You know, the one, you know, this is obviously something I thought a lot about, but, you know, the one sort of astounding lesson that I've learned is that you know, people will, you know, will always look a gift horse in the mouth. And the sense of the sense of entitlement, you know, so like, for example, I mean, by the way, you know, obviously this is so common that we should, rather than rail and shake our fist against it, we should probably understand what's going on. But you know, when I released the book Free, it was free, as you might imagine. But because of publishing rights and contracts, etc., that there's geographic exclusives. So I worked with my publisher when we had the U.S. Installments, and we made it free. But it couldn't be free outside the United States. And so, you know, the Brazilians are like, you know, went apoplectic. And so if you look at the sort of the Google Books or the Scribd thing, it's basically hundreds and hundreds of comments calling me a hypocrite because it's not free in Brazil or it's not free in Italy. And, you know, for the first, like 20 of them, I'm responding. You know, it's like, I'm so sorry, but this is the way the publishing industry works, and I can't, you know, etc. But at the end of the day, I decided to let them rant. But what you realized is that there is absolutely no allowance given for the for the generosity of your act or the work you put into it or anything like that.
Boy, that's an interesting point. Maybe that's what it is, that because we're such a niche culture now, and you can get anything you want exactly the way you want it. Maybe that's what it is. People just kind of get dismissive because they expect everything to fit exactly what they want. When it doesn't, they're just like, "Eh, fuck that thing."
Well, I think it's not free. I think what you were getting at initially, which is that the non-monetary, assets matter more. So what people object to, and we do this all the time, right? So I have an open source hardware company. We do robotics and drones and things like that, and we give away everything for free. And because it's open source, we let people sort of permute it in all sorts of different ways, mm-hmm. and make variations in different hardware, which turns out to be the worst thing you can do if you're trying to remain sane. Because what you have is, because you give people freedom to use it in different ways, they will find inevitably combinations you've never seen before, and it'll break. Mm-hmm. And so you have this tech support nightmare.
Oh.
And you know, and when people come to you, they say, I have this sort of, this GPS module I bought in Vietnam, and it's just not working with your autopilot. What are you going to do about that? And, you know, my first instinct is like, shut the fuck up. You know, what, are you kidding me with this? I mean, you know, this is the recommended hardware. You use something crazy stuff, but that's the wrong answer. You know,
the code is ID10T.
Thank you. God, let's solve that one. The right answer is that you, on some sense, you have to create the incentives for them to, you know, channel their question. You know, the community needs to answer it for them, or the community needs to respond to them, or that you need to create a framework by which they can solve it. But this is, you know, just saying, but it's free and you didn't use our, you know. You just got to get over it, and you got to solve the problem, because it's not going away.
You know, it's amazing, and, you know, like, you, like everyone else, you're a guy, you have things you like, you want to be able to share stuff with the world, and I'm sure, you know, when you're younger and you feel like, oh, if I ever get $1 billion, I'll just give $500 million to or whatever, and then you realize when you start dealing with people en masse, you have to become a politician. Like, you can't just be that guy that you were. You really have to get patient and kind of, you know, because most people will be nice, but then a lot of people will just burrow right under your skin.
I went from sort of like, I talk, you listen, to, you know, public figure, a little bit of, you know, blogs, Twitters, and that stuff. And now I run a community. And, you know, what I realized is the job of community manager. So I thought the job of community manager was, you know, carrot stick, you know, punish bad behavior, you know, et cetera. And there is an element of that. But by and large, my job is Craig and Craigslist. My job is to be nice to everybody, mm-hmm. encouraging whenever possible, to never lose my temper, to when I hear that same question for the 10,000th time, to be as generous and it's like, you know. They say everything I need to learn in life I learned in kindergarten. No. I mean, these are, you know, all those sort of, you know, golden rule laws that you're supposed to have learned when you were a kid, you learn the hard way as a community mm-hmm. manager. Because anytime you violate, anytime you break the law and you're a little bit rude to someone, not only are they wounded, and, you know, because you did it in public, because you have this instinct to do things in public, but they then turn into an enemy. And as a result, they will then endeavor
infect
to
the community
your demise. Yep. And you know, it's just weird watching. It's weird watching these people turn into kind of professional opponents.
Mm-hmm.
Their job, they are now a troll. You've made them into a troll, and they're going to make your life hell.
Yeah.
And you know, I can count on everybody. You know, this is by the way, this is getting a little deep. But you know, what are the lessons of history? You know, when you disrespect a community, you know. Name your community, you know, but some subculture, the Pakistanis in the UK or whatever. And when you say, oh, well, they don't matter. I can, you know, this one won't matter. I can be a little rude to this one.
Right.
You will pay the price.
Right.
It doesn't go away. It comes back. And so sooner or later, they will be empowered and they're going to make your life miserable. And so this is, you know, I mean, maybe if anything, you know, we're learning this kind of incredibly important, you know, sort of, you know, universal truth, which is that, you know, in a world where everyone's empowered and everyone has a megaphone, there is no subgroup that you can mistreat.
Right. Which I think is, and I think is very good. The other side of it, though, is that I think because a lot of times if you're nice to people, well, whether or not you're nice to them, I don't think they realize how they're coming off when they come at you. Mm. And so if you respond rudely, their kind of reaction is, what the fuck did I do? Like, they didn't see the tweet that was like, hey, asshole, why did you... You know, like, some guy... I do a show called Web Soup on G4. It's a spinoff of The Soup. And one time they aired my show in place of Joel McHale's show. So what I got was tweets from people like, hey, asshole, the next time you decide to put your show...
Yeah.
And so... I wrote back to one of these guys and I was like, what the fuck's your problem? The guy's like, what do you mean? He totally didn't see how he was
okay,
coming.
So let me ask you a question. So this is the tactical dilemma of the modern day, which is respond or not. So you know, if you put up a Google alert to, you know, see mentions of you, you will see a fair smattering of jerks.
I did that at one time and took it down.
But you know, just looking at your at replies,
yeah,
you'll see a fair smattering of jerks. Ignore, or you know, so the virtue of ignoring it is that you're not feeding the trolls,
right?
And you don't go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The virtue of responding is that you turn your lemons into lemonade. That you have an opportunity to kind of win over people one at a time. But you know, there are 24 hours in the day. Which do you do?
It's not as black and white for me. I really feel like, and this is a little more time intensive. It's a case by case basis.
Yeah.
And it's easy to say, because a lot of times when people are writing shitty things, you're not really the thing they're mad at.
Mm.
They're upset about. They're just unhappy about something else in general. They stumbled across your thing, and that was the thing that popped their anger zit. And they quickly come at you.
Douche.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I think there's something in our biology. We, you know, we're obviously wired to connect to people eye to eye. Mm-hmm. And so when you're staring at text, you forget you're talking to a human being.
Yeah.
And so I think it just comes off like, oh, well, I'm just throwing this at a robot that has no feelings.
Right.
So, keeping that in mind, if someone writes, you know, hey, you're a douchebag and I hope you die in a car fire, block, which is the most gorgeous feature Twitter has. Block, fine. You don't have to deal with me. I don't have to deal with you.
Yeah.
If someone comes at me with a criticism that is a kind of a good point, or at least I can answer quickly, like, oh, well, I don't control the network, so I can't say what shows get put on. I will direct message them and give them one tweet to see how they respond.
Just to interrupt that at that point, I mean, Twitter's of course completely broken in that respect because then it turns out they don't follow you,
right?
And then what, are you going to respond in public?
No, most of the time I won't respond in public because then if you put it on the public timeline, then people are like, "What's that?" And then you've created a thing,
a little audience for your jerk. Yeah.
I'm happy to have people if they have a real problem. I say, well, email me, you know, like, and make your case.
Yeah.
But, you know, just kind of generic sort of douchey comments like, you know, this other show is better than your show. All right, what am I going to do? Try to convince that guy? Like, he's made his choice. He kind of wanted to take a shot at me. It's fine. Like, I'm on television, and I should be able to take that.
I'm coming around to the sense that there's sort of, you know, the factual errors, and I feel like I should respond to those.
Those are
and
good.
And there's, you know, disagree opinions.
Yeah.
And I'm just not going to respond.
Because most of the time, I think they just... You know, the easiest way to and knowing this, I still play into it, and it sounds like you do too sometimes. They just do it to get your attention so right. that you can engage them, so that it gives them some significance.
But, you know, I mean, I have a hard time letting factual errors hang out there. They can spread.
That's the factual errors is a totally different thing. And for someone like you who runs a magazine and you run a community that is very math based,
yeah,
you kind of have to play whack-a-mole with those. For me, you know, I host a television show. It's like, you know, even the stuff I write for Wired is a lot of it's kind of editorial. So it's you know, it's if someone says, "Hey, that's dumb," then it's like, well, then we have different opinions.
Yeah,
you know, the math doesn't have to check out for me. So I feel like you're in a much different situation from that standpoint.
Well, my you know, what I spend a lot of time just. You know, it's just like children. You know, it's like sleep on it, count to 10.
Yeah.
Sit on your hands.
Yeah.
Bite your tongue. I mean, I spent a lot of my time telling myself, "Do not respond."
Yeah.
Do not respond. And my wife laughs at me when I said someone was mean to me on the internet. She's like, why do you even read this stuff?
It's the exact same thing my girlfriend says to me. But you know, and. It's funny because exactly like you said, I feel like, you know, we're evolved guys. We know how it works. We totally know how digital culture works. We get it. We've been on the web a long time. And yet there's some dumb emotional thing that happens.
Have you ever... So I dream sometimes. You take someone who's just completely vicious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sounding very sort of bruised, but I'm not. But this is the way the conversation went.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take something some really, really vicious, I mean, kind of, you know, it's just like they went above the sort of you suck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And got personal. And then I had this dream of sort of like finding them and confronting them, not punching them in the nose, but just sort of saying, "Here I am."
Yeah.
Tell me more. Have you ever actually encountered somebody who was horrible to you online and, you know, just brought up that you'd read it and seen it and watched them respond?
I don't feel like I've ever met anyone in person where I've said, "Hey, I saw that thing that you wrote." But yeah, I mean, I sort of have those kind of fantasy sometimes where you're like, it would be nice just to see someone face to face so you could say, like, "I'm a person, you're a person."
I'm not looking for an apology. I just want to know why. Why did you write that? You know,
I can tell you it's not you. It's not you. It's not you specifically. Like, whatever they saw about you just tipped it at that point because, you know, when you think of someone who's happy and healthy, they just don't do things like that because it doesn't occur to them to do things like that unless you're talking about, you know, like, you know, you wrote a political article that right. really touched some core belief that they had.
Yeah.
But, you know, but UAVs and television shows, I mean, those don't necessarily hit the core beliefs. Like, those are preferences.
Yeah.
You know, so for someone to flip out over something like that, they're unhappy. So if you take any solace from it, know that they're fucking miserable.
Oh, you know? Good.
But I know, I mean, you know, I'm glad that we're talking about this because, you know, I feel like everyone kind of, I'm sure a lot of people feel that way and they don't, you know, they are a little ashamed to admit it, but it's true. It's like, it is what it is.
Yeah. I just cannot believe that after all this time, I'm, you know, still not more thick skinned and, you know, the truth is, I'm, you know, we must. Here we are. You know, it's 2010. We've managed to survive 20 years of the web.
Yeah.
You know, we must have found some coping strategy. But that sort of, you know, the power of the negative comment versus the positive comment. The total discounting. We discount all positive comments as empty flattery and praise.
Well, also because, you know, I assume you're a civil guy and you would never go up to someone. And I feel like we equate tweets, emails. We equate that as walking up to someone's face and going, "You're a fucking idiot," and you know, like, and you can never imagine yourself doing that to someone because you feel like it just violates every convention of civility that we have, and so you kind of go, "How in the fuck?" You know, but it I just don't think, you know, I would grade it on a curve. Give yourself a letter grade. Okay. Hey, 80% today. I got 80% today from the internet. 20% shit on me, but I still got a B, so that's good.
So we started with the, you started with this question about sort of, you know, wither the kids and all that. But, you know, I think that we are in an intermediate stage, adolescent, juvenile stage of the digital era. You know, despite the fact the web is 20 years old and the internet's 40 years old, you know, the we basically have one generation that's just gotten to kind of, you know, young adulthood or adulthood in the broadband era. So we don't really know where this is going. My suspicion is that the web will be seen, you know, 40 years from now as, you know, as, I mean, not quite AOL, but it will be seen as kind of, you know, it was not the end state by any means. And, you know, we see these very, you know, 30% of the internet traffic is the web and shrinking. You know, there's all these other, you know, sort of gated communities, for lack of a better word. There's, you know, there's the iPad apps, which we're talking about. There's the Facebooks, there's the Twitters, there's the Xbox Lives, etc. All of them are not the web on some level. And each one of them has their own social conventions. And some of them are ADD and some of them are totally immersive, as like in the case of video games or iPad apps. And so I suspect that there's two things going on. First of all, there's probably three things going on. First of all, you know the broadband generation will get older and they'll mature and, you know, they'll learn new social norms and probably become less ADD. Another generation is coming up that is not necessarily going to you know sort of be as seduced by the attractions of screens the way we were. And third, I think we're gonna see that maybe for the just to deal with the fact that, you know, this is kind of a broken social model for many of us, we're gonna come up with these with other non-web things on that take more of our time that don't necessarily have this kind of, you know, asymmetry problems that don't necessarily expose us to so much bruising. We're going to select our communities that sort of satisfy our positive things. And we see this all the time.
We're going to gentrify our own web communities.
Yeah, we're going to gentrify. we find that positive communities grow and negative communities splinter, fragment, and shrink. And so, on some sense, this may just be a Cambrian explosion where you see, a billion different species have flourished, etc. But, you know, the asteroid of kind of like, I don't know what the asteroid is. The analogy may not hold. But at some point, it's going to be a shakeout. And we're going to end up gravitating towards modes of interactions that make us happier.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I also think that you should read a piece that Tim Ferriss wrote about dealing with that exact thing.
His 10 ways of dealing with haters.
Yes, that's the one.
It was brilliant. I passed it around to everybody. Tim is a great example of everything we're talking about here, right? Loads of people hate on Tim, in part because he's super successful, and part of his success is just him. I mean, it's the cult of Tim. But you meet Tim, and he's this awesome guy.
He's amazing.
He is smart, and he is empathetic, and he's a good listener. He's a totally decent guy. I mean, you know, the fact you look at him, you sort of like, he's ballroom dancing, and he's got this hardwood floor, and he's got these umpteen months on the bestseller list, and he's got to be a douchebag. And then you meet him, and he's just not.
He's not. We're having dinner tonight, as a matter of fact. But I feel like he's threatening to a lot of people in the sense they're like, "What the fuck is that guy's problem? How come?" You know, because he's a guy that he'll see a thing and he'll go, "Oh well, I'm just gonna go figure that out." And then he figures it out.
Yeah.
And he's not braggy about it, but he's like, "Here's what I did." You know, take it or leave it.
So in your show notes, you should link to that post for those who haven't read it, because I think that his advice to dealing with haters, which really encompasses a lot of things we talked about so far, is, you know, if you just read it and remember 2 of the 10. You will be a happier person.
You know what's going to happen now is that now we're going to get the hate tweets that are like, "Chris Evans and Chris Anderson are just complaining about the internet." Like, that's not the point of the internet.
Shit. Was like, oh no, I take it all back.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Me too. Please,
I think
please, internet.
About the web.
Please, web. I love you, web. I love you, web. I love you, the web.
Yeah.
I just read a fascinating sort of breakdown of, why web conventions are what they are, and just the sort of not necessarily arbitrary, but just sort of like, oh, you know, the forward slashes aren't really necessary. They were just to sort of divide up. And it's, you know, like so many of these still are archaic things that we have in place just because, you know, Tim Berners-Lee and a bunch of other people were like, oh, we'll just make them this.
So do you know people who are still typing www?
No.
There are people out there who still type. There are people out there who still say www.
Oh, really?
I think those people include NPR anchors.
Which is funny because NPR has like one of the slickest iPad apps that I've ever seen. They seem somewhat
the style guide may not have gotten on board with the W's not required.
You know, I've just
at least they don't say HTTP colon.
It's colon. It's forward slash forward slash. I've been doing the control enter thing for so long that I just don't. It's, you know, like a lot of times I don't even type in. I just do like keyboard shortcuts.
Well, I have weirdly found myself that I used to mock people who typed URLs into Google.
Uh-huh.
And now I find I'm one of those. I just, you know, I we're so lazy. I cannot be bothered to think about spelling or I can't be bothered to think, even remember. And I don't know how many neurons are required even to remember, I mean, what the URL was. I just sort of type some random text that's sort of more or less like it. And the magic happens.
Are we going to see some sort of change in domain addressing? I mean, or do you think we're stuck to?
I don't know.
We're stuck to that for a while.
I mean, that was a very, you know, 10 years ago. There was the notion that you would have these kind of, you know, the super layer of domains.
I want to start squatting on the super layer.
Yeah. No, I'm just. I think what's happening is that you know, thanks. I thank the iPhone for this because it's impossible to type on the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And you mistype. You need something that sort of guesses at what you meant.
Right.
It. And basically it's training us to sort of say whatever, you know, sort of like I was looking for a restaurant and, you know, I on Google Maps and I was like, you know, it was you know, the restaurant was like, you know, Amber on Yerba Buena in San Francisco Indian food, you know, that should have been the correct string,
right?
And instead I was like, you know AMRER San,
there's probably a Q in there somewhere,
and you know, it sort of got maybe 30% of the letters right, and you know, half of the thing, and just sort of said, let it figure out.
Yeah,
and you know, magic happened and it worked.
Now, see, I like that idea of technology that is just kind of an exasperated butler, sort of like you're this ape trying to mash bread at a toaster, and it's like, here, I'll get. Did you mean to toast this? You probably meant that.
Exactly. Now that is making us stupid.
Yeah, because, you know, we're basically using computers in the cloud to be our external hard drives,
yeah.
And now to just correct stuff. I still get insane when I see the your contraction,
yeah.
Your possessive.
Yeah.
Mix and match, and so many people do it now.
I know, and I'm wrestling with this because so that Malcolm Gladwell had this sort of famous piece about, you know, it must have been 15 years ago, about disqualifying remarks, and this is when somebody does something, and there's a couple of disqualifying actions, so like being rude to a waiter, or you know, or sort of, you know, telling you that they're spiritual on first meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. These are the kind of things where you suddenly they're the proxies for everything you need to know about this person is now revealed by the way they ordered. I used to think that confusing your was absolutely disqualifying. and now it's, as you say, it's so ubiquitous, and comes from the smartest people, and is clearly a kind of an artifact of keyboards rather than education. I'm kind of like, okay. I'm just going to be cool with this.
Not so bad.
You know, you can turn into Strunk and White pretty easily.
Right.
And you know, sort of like incorrect usage. You know, these are the 32 BC guys, mm-hmm. Right? It's pedantry. And you just got to get over it. It's like, okay, it's not you. It's your keyboard.
It was a pain in the ass to go up to that apostrophe to create the contraction you are, as opposed
I'm
to saying that
tell
you
myself,
have ownership of something.
I'm tell myself it's about the apostrophe. Not...
Do you like... Because in one of the first sentences of the free book, you're referencing Monty Python.
Yeah.
So are you a big comedy fan in that sense?
No, and I, not knowing who Bill Hicks was, I've revealed myself. No, not really. It's been interesting. I've been, you know, now that I've got kids, I've been sort of bringing out movies that I thought were very, very funny from my childhood and introducing them to my kids, and they just sort of stare at them.
Serpico, not a funny movie.
I haven't tried that one, but I've yet to succeed. So I, Spinal Tap, what a freaking disaster that was.
What?
So you and I remember Spinal Tap as being awesome funny, right?
Yes.
When was the last time you've seen it?
I saw it sometime within the last couple of years.
Really?
Yeah.
My kids, I mean, it's slow.
Too slow for them?
Well, there's only about three jokes in the whole, right? There's 11.
Right.
There's the little Stonehenge. And there's probably another joke that I can't remember. There aren't a lot of jokes.
Oh my God, I feel like that is so loaded. You know, I still love that movie. Like when the manager says to David Sade Hubbins' girlfriend that she dresses like an Australian's nightmare, that is hilarious to me.
So that kind of went over their head.
Okay.
You mentioned Monty Python, and I was really worried about Monty Python. Because I was like, oh my God, you know, I think of Monty Python as being a high density comedy.
There's so much physical comedy in it, though.
And I thought it would work. And then we started with the dead parrot sketch.
Mm-hmm.
The dead parrot sketch. First of all, one of my favorite lines from it is he joined the choir invisible. Is that actually in it?
I thought it was.
Because we went. Maybe there's two dead parrot sketches. Because the one we went looking for. Oh no! The polygon. It's a polygon.
Oh, that's polygon? That's not in it.
And so either I have sort of been sort of riffing off dead parrot things as a child and invented the polygon line, or it's in a different version of it or whatever. But I was like, oh, well, there's this other funny part that's not in here.
Well, you know, they did a lot of I'm sure I'm going to get shit on for not remembering every line of the dead parrot sketch, but you know, they did that live a lot as well. So maybe you heard a recording where they added stuff. I'm pretty sure they also did it in German. They did it in many languages.
So Monty Python worked better than most. So I'm pretty, you know, that one did cross. As I say, Spinal Tap definitely did not cross. My next test is Buckaroo Banzai. Do you think that'll work?
I remember as a kid being, because Buckaroo Banzai came out when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And I feel it was like 87, right? 86, 87?
Probably, maybe a little earlier.
If that was the case, then I was around high school, and I remember Buckaroo not being as action packed as I had wanted it to be, and sort of feeling like, wait, I don't understand. Who are these Rasta aliens? Like, and I feel like if I had been a few years older, I probably would have appreciated it more. So I don't know if it's as. I mean, maybe they might like the alien, you know, just like the alien part of it.
Well, it needs to be pretty fast-paced.
I will say this. I can't see Peter Weller doing a kids' show. Peter Weller's probably not my first choice for welcome to Learning with Peter Weller. Like, okay, get to it. Colors are... Okay, I get it. And then you take... Peter, please. Like, so I think he's maybe not the best kids... It's not going to win a Kids' Choice Award, Peter Weller.
So we tried Caddyshack, bit slow. Spaceballs, perfect.
For kids. Yeah.
We did National Lampoon's American Vacation.
Wait, how old are your kids?
From 2 to 13.
Okay.
So, you know, it's hard. The density is hard. Ghostbusters... not quite as successful as I'd hoped.
Really?
Yeah.
The movie changed my life when I saw it in the theater. I know, but I was a little older.
I think they found the special effects a little cheesy.
That's, you know, and at the time, groundbreaking special effects.
I know. Anyway, so it's again, you know, it's when you're trying to remember what's you asked about comedy and I'm coming back and ask these sort of fundamental questions about what was really funny or what was I just young.
Mm-hmm.
For. And so you revisit these kind of things, you can see the distinction. And the simple answer is that Monty Python, I think, passes the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
It still works, but most of the other stuff that I thought was hilarious didn't.
Didn't stand the test of time for kids.
Yeah.
Damn it! I don't have any kids yet, so that's what I have to look forward to when I'm like, God damn it, Caddyshack is hilarious! What is wrong with you? You're not my son! I'm going to get mad at some poor kid.
Yeah, this is very risky. When your treasured, you know, cultural artifacts from your youth, when you expose it to your children, they can shit on your childhood.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there was also with Caddyshack too. There was it was sort of part of the culture. That movie kind of came out of the culture of the 80s as well. And so maybe it was tied to it in some way that way. I don't know. But I still will watch that movie and quote it 150 times. How do you manage your time? How the fuck do you manage? How do you run? How do you? First of all, how do you have, community of UAVs? You write books. You know, you run an enormous magazine. You have kids. Like when you wake up each day, how do you know what to do? Do you just kind of whatever's in front of you, or do you actually have a plan?
Yeah, I have a plan. Three or 400 emails a day. It's a lot. The simple answer is that the only way you can do lots of things is if you sort of delegate. Mm-hmm. So at Wired, we've got terrific. I've been doing this 9 years. I can't believe it, but I've been doing this 9 years. So at this point, we have quite a good system in place, and delegation is and is doing well. And so functionally, my input is at the kind of the commissioning stage, what stories will we run, what we won't, and then at the end the Q&A, sort of reviewing all the spreads and reading things for the last time. And in between, I kind of let people do their own thing, which is, it's I suppose on some levels empowering, on other sense it's neglectful, but it's just sort of the way it works, and every editor works differently. When it comes to the community management stuff, you can't take your eye off that for a minute. And we use super geeky answer, but we're on the Ning network.
Yeah.
And the Ning network is, as much as I love it, it doesn't have enough tools to really let community management work right. So there's not enough granularity of rights that we can give individual members, from moderator to mm-hmm. all the way to admin, etc. And so I'm kind of doing more than I need to. We don't have badges where you can give people sort of noob ninja,
right.
Like that. So we don't have these positive incentives. It's just it needs to kind of get one level further in terms of sort of social network, community management tools, mm-hmm. and then I think I'll be able to delegate a lot more of the work of community management to the community itself. Then the spin out of that community is a company where we make autopilots and UAVs and quadcopters and all this kind of stuff, and that right now is in a really high intensity CEO kind of role, where we're going to production. We just got to pick and place machines, so we're making printed circuit boards and we're doing inventory management, and this is really kind of this is my entrepreneur hat on right now. And right now I'm super needed to make decisions and pick products and kind of create our, set up our dev teams and our collaboration network. And I suspect that'll last, for another year or so before that kind of starts to run itself. And then there's, speaking in books, and my next book isn't due until September of next year. Unfortunately, the next book, is built on this sort of new industrial revolution model. This atoms are the new bits, is kind of an outgrowth of the work I'm doing already. So my life is kind of, in some sense, the research for the book, but that's going to get crazy. And starting at kind of the end of this year, mm-hmm. I'm going to have to focus and Starbucks with the headsets on, etc. And then weekends are for kids, and I try to sort of spend some time there, but I'm probably neglecting them on some level. Don't sleep a lot. Don't watch television ever. No television is my productivity secret. No sports. No watching sports.
Well, sports. I mean, like you, I don't understand anything about sports. So I just, even if I had all the time in the world, I never watched it even when I had time. I don't get it.
Clay Shirky's book about cognitive surplus is, it really starts with the anecdote of if you took the time that people invest watching television and you just applied it to something else, you'd change the world. I mean, you'd solve all the world's problems right there by putting, by putting those brain cells to work. Now, obviously, we watch television because they satisfy some sort of, need to veg out or to be entertained or to not necessarily be actively participating. But, the truth is, we've got a lot of spare cycles. And I don't want to be the anti-TV guy. I think this is the golden age of television. It's never been any better than it is right now, and it is increasingly hard to resist watching television. But that is my one discipline. I will not watch television. And while when it's the final episode of Lost, I am, you know, getting a little bit of a leg up on the rest of the world by working my ass off. And the Super Bowl is a 2-3 hours, and the Oscars are another 3 hours that I get competitive advantage. And so that's my little trick.
That's good. When you're, I sold a book and I have to start writing it soon, but it's not due till the end of the year. What do you use for? Do you use any particular software to cull your ideas, or do you?
You know, I'm a big fan of outlines, mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, basically, you know, building the outline and fleshing out the outline, populating the outline, revising the outline is crucial. And I use this ancient bit of software on a PC called Action Outline, I don't know whether it's good or bad, but it works for me. I tried using Word's outline function. It's incredible complexity. So my method is basically to you know, always be gathering string, mm-hmm. Put the string in the right place, and that place is in an outline in the right place. And you know, eventually you'll find that this. What I'll find is that you know, you start with an outline, mm-hmm. and then you start putting in string, you know, links and things you've read and little bits you've written and that kind of stuff, and you'll find that there's entire branches of the outline that are empty, and that's telling you that you thought this was a rich seam, but it's not.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So, you know, yeah, just constantly revise, populate. If something's looking empty, ask yourself, why is this empty?
Because I am empty.
Well, is your book coming entirely out of your own head?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
It's kind of a, it's sort of branching off. I wrote the productivity piece for you guys last year, and it's sort of branching off that idea in that I feel like nerds in general have a very specific way for how they approach things. And so the idea is, you know, here's how I, with this kind of obsessive brain, here's how I tried to tweak it to sort of aim its beam for good, as opposed to, you know, I mean, listen, I'm not perfect. Like, you know, you and I just obsessed for 15 minutes over negative tweets, you know, like, obviously if I could.
You totally got to edit that stuff down. That was a real cri de coeur.
No. I think it's good. I think it's good because it's human and it's something that, you know, I mean, it's not like, I don't feel like we're totally serious about it. Like, to a degree, it's sort of like, oh, you shake your fist. Mm. Ultimately, we're smart enough to know, like, all right, it is silly. You know, like, I still appreciate the web, and I still appreciate the positive things that people say. But, I mean, it's just sort of that idea of, it's sort of the idea of, you know, if you have a nerd brain, this is a good, these are some tricks that I use to try to organize my time, organize my emotions, organize my health, you know, like, think.
What's the title?
It's called The Nerdist Way.
I have to ask, how do you get off calling yourself a nerd?
You know, I get that question asked a lot, and there's
no way you're a nerd.
I get that question a lot, and it is it's a fair question. I've been a technophile my entire life.
That doesn't make you a nerd.
It does. I obsessed over computers. I got my first computer in 1981. I played D&D. I have chess trophies.
I know this is the most boring conversation you ever have.
No,
but everything you've said is geek.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying nerd versus geek.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're a geek. You're not a nerd. Geeks, everyone has their own definition, but I'm just going to have to do it here.
Yes.
Geeks are obsessive, but may have social skills, may have you know, they can be cool. Nerds are typically lacking in social skills.
See, this is a semantic issue because I think the comparison, the vocabulary that I use in my head is nerd versus dweeb. Like, I look at dweebs and I go, the dweebs are the ones that don't have the social, they're the ones that, you know, swallow in the middle of sentences and can't, and sweat.
But back to geek. So why do you pick nerd versus geek?
Because geek was not a popular word when I mean, nerd was a label that,
excuse me.
Oh, that's all right.
Sorry.
That's okay. Nerd was the word that was used when I was growing up to refer to me, you know, in computer club or chess club or whatever. We didn't say geek in the early 80s, you know, like there was no, nerd now is, it's almost a weird badge of honor because it kind of says like, oh, you know, you're thoughtful and you can make stuff. But nerd in the 80s, there was no irony behind it. It was just, you're a nerd. Like, I didn't hear the word geek a lot when I was a kid. It was nerd. Like when Revenge of the Nerds came out, like that movie, I bonded with that movie so hard because it was a word. So, you know, I'm using it as it was just part of the vernacular of where I grew up and the social circle that I was in grade school.
Okay, but what there must be some pretension in using it today. Is it mock humility?
I think it's taking ownership of, you know, something that was basically at the time is kind of emotionally disruptive, you know,
it's retro. It's kind of the Atari generation designation.
I think it's like the vagina monologues. I'm going to take back the word pussy or whatever.
Okay.
It's sort of like,
okay,
I'm taking it back. Like, it was assigned to me when I was a kid. I had no control over that. Now I'm taking it back because, you know, people who grew up that way, a lot of them now run a lot of things. And so I see it as sort of empowering in a way. I'm not going to go as far as compare it to the other N-word, but I will say there is a sense of I genuinely suffered for this word when I was growing up. I'm kind of taking it back and trying to make something productive out of it.
So just to confirm, the sort of the geek nerd division that I see as a nerd dweeb.
I see it as nerd dweeb
division.
Yeah,
and if I'm your publisher,
mm-hmm,
we're trying to sell some books here.
Yeah,
you want people to resonate. You want them to sort of self-define.
Sure. Yeah,
and there's enough people out there that self-define as nerd, because I would have thought that lots of people self-define as geeks, but few people self-define as nerds. Other people define them as nerds.
I see the word nerd thrown around more than I see geek. Now, one of my best friends, Will Wheaton, he uses geek.
Right.
But Will is always four steps ahead of me and most other people. So then I kind of feel like, oh, well, maybe he's got it right and I don't. I'm just using it for my personal experience. And Nerdist happens to be the name of my website and the podcast and everything.
We've got the domain, so go with it.
Yeah. I'm using, when I say the Nerdist way, it's more assigning to me specifically as that point of view, you know, rather than just, you know, saying like, the Nerd Recipe Cookbook.
Is there any television celebrity outside yourself who would self-define as a nerd?
I think a lot of people use the term. I mean, and I'm sure I'm, like, you know, like you asked me the question. I'm sure a lot of people feel that I use it improperly when referring to myself. I think a lot of people use it because, you know, I think a lot of actors use it. Like, hot girl actors use it all the time. Oh, I'm just a nerd. You know, like, no, don't confuse the fact that you're so hot that people have difficulty talking to you as you being a nerd. They're just, people are socially awkward around you, you know. But a lot of actors use the term nerd.
Really?
Yeah. I'm just a big nerd. They'll say, I'm just a big nerd.
So that's totally faux humility, right?
Yeah, I think it probably is.
So there's lots of fake self-definition as nerd, but is there any authentic, nerds?
I don't know if it's fake. I don't know if it's fake because I feel like, you know, because we're all human, everyone probably feels awkward. And so they to a degree. And so maybe that's just a word that they use to kind of say, like, hey, I'm just a human being. I'm a big nerd.
Okay.
You know, I think. But I'm sure there is some faux humility as well.
I can totally see how sort of cool, balanced people can sort of embrace their inner nerd.
Right.
But do any real nerds embrace their inner nerd?
Well, I don't know, because sadly, I think what we're learning is that a lot of the people in the early 80s that we were like, look at those nerds, actually had Asperger's. And wasn't something that was defined back then. So, and I don't mean that in a joke, but I mean literally, I think that happened, where a lot of people were like, you know, back of the line nerd. It was some poor kid who actually had a syndrome. And a lot of those kids were my friends.
I'd always hoped that I'd be sort of, you know, professionally diagnosed with Asperger's, because it would forgive all sorts of sins. It's like, I'm not a jerk, I've just got Asperger's.
Well, there's also something to, you know, taking the nerd word back now is just sort of saying, like, hey, you know, you can be proud of the fact that you obsess about things. You can be proud of the fact that you're not stupid. You can be proud of the fact that you're sensitive and, you know, thoughtful. Like, you can be proud of those things.
I do think we have a perfectly adequate word for that, and it's geek. But I'll let that one go.
We're divided in the nerd-geek debate, which, by the way, will rage on long after this podcast is over.
Absolutely. Well, we have a site called Geek Dad.
Uh-huh. Yes, Geek Dad, and he did stuff for the
Will,
Wire TV
Will
show.
Wheaton is a Geek Dad.
Yes, he is. Geek Dad is wonderful, by the way.
Yeah. So Ken Denmead is the editor, and there's another classic case of delegation. I started it on the hope that I could, I wanted to do geeky things and I wanted to be a good father. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, there's just not enough things that are fun for me and fun for them. And so we'd start this, and I got about sort of like a week into it and realized that I was actually not that interested in inventing projects for my children to reject. But fortunately, there's lots of other people out there who are really good, you know, who really do get the balance right and actually do spend their time doing fantastic projects with their kids, who are receptive and participate. You know, for every geek dad, you need a geek kid.
Mm-hmm.
Geek dads with cool kids, cool dads with geek kids. That, you know,
that's the show family ties right there. The Alex P. Keaton.
There you go.
Yes.
So anyway, so Ken has found a whole bunch of people who get the balance exactly right. And my point was only that the geek dad designation was all about the sort of, you know, the unnecessary and excessive fascination with something, be it science, technology, mm-hmm. or just projects that allow you to do things that are that really can't be explained in any other way. How did you spend 2 days building a cardboard rocket ship? Because we could.
Yeah.
You know, these are all the questions that sort of fail the test of why.
Yeah, well, and also a lot of stuff you see at Maker Faire, like that R2-D2 club is ridiculously amazing.
Absolutely. So that's the beautiful moment where you kind of went down the rabbit hole and got obsessed with something that made no sense and yet gave you undue pleasure,
complete joy. And that is. You know, when I talk about the Nerdist and the Nerdist community, I think of them as creative obsessives. Like, they're not just, you know, they're not just obsessive. They're people who also contribute as well as obsess, you know? And I feel like that's a really nice crossroads.
And I think that, you know, the golden rule is never ask why.
I don't think we know why exactly, you know? Like, it could be years of therapy trying to figure all that out.
Don't make me confront the reality that it's stupid and I shouldn't have done it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time. You have donated an enormous amount of time to me. But this has been a wonderful chat. And so people can find you at DIY Drones. They can find you at http://www.diydrones.
I don't know whether I set up the domain. I'm not even sure www works. I mean,
oh really? You just it's a DIY drones. No.
Anyway, yeah. So you can follow the nerd side of me at DIY Drones. You can probably follow the geek side of me at on my Twitter feed, and you can follow the professional, fully evolved. And magazine editor guy.
And by the way, you are involved with TED a lot, but there is also another TED, Chris Anderson.
There is another TED, Chris Anderson. You know, many parallels. Wired was founded at TED. I speak at TED. Chris is a friend. He's British. I'm British by birth. And, you know, he was used to be a magazine editor. And we decided that this is a case where we both benefit from the confusion, that people give me credit for his triumphs. And
yeah, because someone recently was like, did you see Chris Anderson was really mad at Sarah Silverman because of what she did at TED? And I was like, really? I don't. And they say, yeah, he tweeted about it. I'm like, I can't imagine the Chris Anderson that I know doing that. And then I realized, oh, it's a different Chris Anderson.
Yeah, mostly it's positive. It's largely 1+1=3. And, you know, I occasionally we have moments where my failures, diminish the Chris Anderson brand. But by and large, I get credit for starting TED.
Have you thought about coming together to form a unified Chris Anderson?
We have considered M&A, but the five children, I think, were a deal breaker.
I will have to say that it is awesome that you both. I mean, like that would be a good union. The other Chris Hardwick out there he's a Rubik's Cube champion. I don't know how to. I mean, I guess I could integrate that
division
somehow.
Division of
labor. You think that's what it is?
Podcast, Rubik's Cube. You know, no confusion.
The other Chris Hardwick solves like 1,000-sided theoretical cubes mathematically, in addition to, you know, blindfolded with one hand on a.
How does this not totally enhance your brand?
You know, it does, because I'll get tweets every once in a while where people are like, "Hey, Rubik's Cube, nice," and I kind of let it slide. I'm like, you know what?
Totally.
I'm not going to go out of my way to tell them that I'm not that guy.
Well, there's a third Chris Anderson who's a professional basketball player, and that just confuses people.
Yeah, that confuses people, because then you wouldn't even watch your own games, because that's boring.
I'd be fuzzy on the concept. They'd I don't know. They only have to meet me, and then it's all solved.
Well, thank you very much for letting me come in and chat with you at Wired, Chris Anderson.
Total pleasure, Chris.
All right.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 65th National Finals of Distinguished Young Women.
Every year, one girl from every state leaves her family, her whole life behind, for 2 weeks and spends each day training, practicing, preparing. Because to win this competition, she needs to wow a panel of judges with her academic record, her athletic ability, her speaking skills, and a show-stopping talent.
I met her and I was like, she's gonna win.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
When I sing that song about being a black woman in America, there's gonna be backlash about that.
Oh, I'm just so happy. So happy.
I don't wanna see them. I don't wanna talk to them.
And then we stayed with them for the next year, unpacking just what happened those 2 weeks in Mobile. I'm Shimolyai, and from Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.